Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Legalese podcast. This podcast brings you truth, power, and awareness. I'm your host, Mel Marie. Today, we'll be discussing the former President Trump's election indictment. This will be the seventh episode of an eight-part series covering the New York, Mar-a-Lago, and election indictments. This episode will cover the second set of 15 pages of the election indictment developed by Special Counsel Jack Smith. On January 2nd, 4 days before Congress's certification proceeding, the defendant and others called Georgia's Secretary of State. During the call, the defendant lied to the Georgia Secretary of State to induce him to alter Georgia's popular vote count and call into question the validity of Biden's electors' votes, which had been transmitted to Congress weeks before, including as follows. The defendant raised allegations regarding the State Farm Arena video and repeatedly disparaged one of the same election workers that Rudy Giuliani had maligned on December 10th, using her name almost 20 times and falsely referring to her as a professional vote scammer and hustler. In response, the Georgia Secretary of State refuted this. Quote, you're talking about the State Farm video, and I think it's extremely unfortunate that Giuliani or his people, they sliced and diced that video and took it out of context. When the Georgia Secretary of State then offered a link to a video that would disprove Giuliani's claims, the defendant responded, I don't care about the link. I don't need it. I have a much, Georgia Secretary of State, I have a much better link. The defendant asked about rumors that paper ballots cast in the election were destroyed, and the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel explained to him that the claim had been investigated and was not true. The defendant claimed that 5,000 dead people voted in Georgia, causing the Georgia Secretary of State to respond. Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong. The actual number were two. Two people that were dead that voted. And so your information is wrong. That was two. The defendant claimed that thousands of out-of-state voters had cast ballots in Georgia's election, which the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel refuted, explaining, we've been going through each of those as well, and those numbers that we got that the defendant's counsel was just saying are not accurate. Every one we've been through are people that lived in Georgia, moved to a different state, but then moved back to Georgia legitimately. They moved back in years ago. This is not like something just before the election. In response to multiple other of the defendant's allegations, the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel told the defendant that the Georgia Bureau of Investigation was examining all such claims and finding no merit to them. The defendant said that he needed to find 11,780 votes and insinuated that Georgia Secretary of State and his counsel could be subject to criminal prosecution if they failed to find election fraud, as he demanded, stating, quote, and you are going to find that they are, which is totally illegal. It's more illegal for you than it is for them because you know what they did and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal, you know, that's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to the Georgia Secretary of State's counsel, your lawyer. Unquote. The next day, on January 3rd, the defendant falsely claimed that the Georgia Secretary of State had not addressed the defendant's allegations, publicly stating that the Georgia Secretary of State was unwilling or unable to answer questions such as the ballots under table scam, ballot destruction, out-of-state voters, dead voters, and more. He has no clue. Quote, unquote. Okay. On January 6th, the defendant publicly repeated the knowingly false insinuation that more than 10,300 dead people voted in Georgia, Michigan. On November 5th, 2020, the defendant claimed that there had been a suspicious dump of votes, purportedly illegitimate ballots, stating, quote, "In Detroit, there were hours of unexplained delay in delivering many of the votes from counting. The final batch did not arrive until 4 in the morning, even though the polls closed at 8 o'clock. So they brought it in, and the batches came in, and no one knew where they were from." On November 20th, 3 days before Michigan's governor signed a certificate of ascertainment notifying the federal government that based on the popular vote, Biden's electors were to represent Michigan's voters, the defendant held a meeting in the Oval Office with the Speaker of the Michigan House of Representatives and the Majority Leader of the Michigan Senate. In the meeting, the defendant raised his false claims, among others, of illegitimate vote dump in Detroit. In response, the Michigan Senate Majority Leader told the defendant that he had lost Michigan not because of fraud, but because the defendant had underperformed with certain voter population in the state. Upon leaving their meeting, the Michigan House Speaker and Michigan Senate Majority Leader issued a statement reiterating this. The statement claims, "The Senate and the House Oversight Committees are actively engaged in a thorough review of Michigan's election process, as we have faith in the committee process to provide greater transparency and accountability to our citizens. We have not yet been made aware of any information that would change the outcome of the election in Michigan and the legislative leaders, as we will follow the law and follow the normal process regarding Michigan's electors, just as we have said throughout this election." On December 1st, the defendant raised his Michigan vote dump claim with the Attorney General, who responded that what had occurred in Michigan had been the normal voting count process and that there was no indication of fraud in Detroit. Despite this, the next day, the defendant made a knowingly false statement that in Michigan, quote, "At 6:31 in the morning, a vote dump of 149,772 votes came in unexpectedly. We were winning by a lot. That batch was received in horror. Nobody knows anything about it. It's corrupt. Detroit is corrupt. I have a lot of friends in Detroit. They know it, but Detroit is totally corrupt," unquote. On December 4th, Rudy Giuliani sent a text message to the Michigan House Speaker reiterating his unsupported claim of election fraud and attempting to get Michigan's House Speaker to assist in reversing the ascertainment of the legitimate Biden electors, stating, quote, "Looks like Georgia may well hold some factual hearings and change the certification under ART2, Section 1, CL2 of the Constitution. As Co-Conspirator 2 explained, they don't just have the right to do it, but the obligation. Help me get this done in Michigan," he stated. Similarly, on December 7th, despite still having established no fraud in Michigan, Giuliani sent a text for the Michigan Senate Majority Leader claiming, "So I need you to pass a joint resolution from the Michigan legislature that states that the election is in dispute. There is an ongoing investigation by the legislator and the electors sent by Governor Whitmer. are not the official electors of the state of Michigan and do not fall within the safe harbor deadline of December 8th under Michigan law. Unquote. On December 14th, the day that electors in the state across the country were required to vote and submit their votes to Congress, the Michigan House Speaker and Michigan Senate Majority Leader announced that, contrary to defendants' request, they would not decertify the legitimate election results or electors in Michigan. The Michigan Senate Majority Leader's public statement included, "We have not received evidence of fraud on a scale that would change the outcome of the election in Michigan." The Michigan's House Speaker public statement read in part, "We've diligently examined these reports of fraud to the best of our ability. I fought hard for President Trump. No one wanted him to win more than me. I think he's done an incredible job. But I love our republic too. I can't fathom risking our norms, traditions, and institutions to pass a resolution retroactively changing the electors for Trump, simply because some think there may have been enough widespread fraud to give him the win. That's unprecedented for a good reason. And that's why there is not enough support in the House to cast a new slate of electors. I fear we'd lose our country forever. This truly would bring mutually assured destruction for every future election in regards to the Electoral College. And I can't stand for that. I won't." On January 6, 2021, the defendant publicly repeated this his knowingly false claim regarding an illicit dump of more than 100,000 ballots in Detroit, Pennsylvania. On November 11, 2020, the defendant publicly maligned the Philadelphia City Commissioner for stating that on the news that there was no evidence of widespread fraud in Philadelphia. As a result, the Philadelphia City Commissioner and his family received death threats. On November 25th, the day after Pennsylvania's governor signed a certificate of ascertainment and thus certified to the federal government that Biden's electors were legitimate electors of the state, Giuliani orchestrated an event at a hotel in Gettysburg, attended by state legislators. Giuliani falsely claimed that Pennsylvania had issued 1.8 million absentee ballots and received 2.5 million in return. In the days thereafter, the campaign staffer wrote internally that Giuliani's allegations were just wrong and there was no way to defend it. The deputy campaign manager responded, "We have been saying this for a while. It's very frustrating." On December 4th, after four Republican leaders of the Pennsylvania legislature issued a public statement that the General Assembly lacked the authority to overturn the popular vote and appoint its own slate of electors, and that doing so would violate the state election code and constitution, the defendant retweeted a post labeling the legislators cowards. On December 30th and January 3rd, the defendant repeatedly raised with the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general the allegations that in Pennsylvania there had been 205,500 more votes than voters. Each time the Justice Department officials informed the defendant that his claims were false. On January 6th, 2021, the defendant publicly repeated his knowingly false claim that there had been 205,000 more votes than voters in Pennsylvania. Wisconsin. On November 29th, 2020, a recount in Wisconsin that the defendant's campaign had petitioned and paid for did not change the election result and in fact increased the defendant's margin of defeat. On December 14th, the Wisconsin Supreme Court rejected an election challenge by the campaign. One justice wrote, quote, "Nothing in this case casts any legitimate doubt that the people of Wisconsin lawfully chose Vice President Biden and Senator Harris to be the next leaders of our great country. Unquote. On December 21st, as a result of the state Supreme Court's decision, the Wisconsin governor, who had signed a certificate of ascertainment on November 30th, identifying Biden's electors as the state's legitimate electors, signed a certificate of final determination in which the recognized that the state's Supreme Court had resolved a controversy regarding the appointment of Biden's electors and confirmed that Biden had received the highest number of votes in the state and that his electors were the state's legitimate electors. That same day, in response to the court's decision that had prompted the Wisconsin governor to sign a certificate of final determination, the defendant issued a tweet repeating his knowingly false claims of election fraud and demanding that the Wisconsin legislature overturn the election results that had led to the ascertainment of Biden's electors as legitimate electors. On December 27th, the defendant raised with the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general a specific fraud claim that there had been more votes than voters in Wisconsin. The acting deputy attorney general informed the defendant that his claims was false. On January 6, 2021, the defendant publicly repeated knowingly false claims that there had been tens of thousands of unlawful votes in Wisconsin. The defendant's use of dishonesty, fraud, and deceit to organize fraudulent slates of electors and cause them to transmit false certificates to Congress. As the defendant's attempt to obstruct the electoral vote through deceit of state officials met with repeated failure beginning early December 2020, he and co-conspirators developed a new plan to marshal individuals who had served as the defendant's electors had he won the popular vote in seven target states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and caused those individuals to make and send the vice president and Congress false certifications that they were legitimate electors. Under the plan, the submission of these fraudulent slates would create a false controversy at the certification proceeding and position the vice president presiding on January 6th as president of the Senate to supplant legitimate electors with the defendant's fake electors and certify the defendant as president. The plan capitalized on ideas presented on memoranda drafted by co-conspirator 5, an attorney who was assisting the defendant's campaign with legal efforts related to recount in Wisconsin. The memoranda evolved over time from a legal strategy to preserve the defendant's right to a corrupt plan to subvert the federal government function by stopping Biden electors' votes from being counted and certified as follows. Okay. The November 18th memorandum, Wisconsin memo, advocated that because of the ongoing recount in Wisconsin, the defendant's electors there should meet and cast the votes on December 14th, the date the ECA required appointed electors to vote. To preserve the alternative of the defendant's Wisconsin elector slate in the event that the defendant ultimately prevailed in the state. The December 6th memorandum, fraudulent elector memo, marked a sharp departure from co-conspirators 5's Wisconsin memo, advocating that the alternate electors originally conceived of to preserve rights in Wisconsin instead be used in a number of states as fraudulent electors to prevent Biden from receiving the 270 electoral votes necessary to secure the presidency on January 6th. The fraudulent elector memo suggested that defendants' electors in six purportedly contested states, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, should meet and mimic as best as possible the actions of legitimate Biden electors, and that on January 6th, the vice president should open and count the fraudulent votes, setting up a fake controversy that would derail the proper certification of Biden as president-elect. The December 9 memorandum, fraudulent elector instructions, consisted of co-conspirator 5's instructions of how fraudulent electors could mimic legitimate electors in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Co-conspirator 5 noted that in some states, it would be virtually impossible for the fraudulent electors to successfully take the same steps as legitimate electors because the state law required formal participation in the process by state officials or access to official resources. The plan began in early December, and ultimately the conspirators and the defendants' campaign took the Wisconsin memo and expanded it to any state that the defendant claimed was contested, even New Mexico, which the defendant had lost more than 10% of the popular vote. This expansion was forecasted by emails the defendant's chief of staff sent on December 6th, forwarding the Wisconsin memo to campaign staff and writing, quote, "We just need to have someone coordinating the electors for states." On December 6th, the defendant and co-conspirator 2 called the chairwoman of the Republican National Committee to ensure that the plan was in motion. During the call, co-conspirator 2 told the chairwoman that it was important for the RNC to help the defendant's campaign gather electors in targeted states and falsely represented to her that state electors' votes would be used only if ongoing litigation in one of the states changed the results of in the defendant's favor. After the RNC chairwoman consulted the campaign and heard that work on gathering electors was underway, she called and reported this information to the defendant, who responded approvingly. On December 7th, Giuliani received the Wisconsin memo and the fraudulent elector memo. Giuliani spoke with co-conspirator 6, who's unknown or unnamed, regarding attorneys who could assist in the fraudulent elector efforts in the targeted states, and he received from co-conspirator 6 an email identifying attorneys in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The next day, on December 8th, co-conspirator 5 called the Arizona attorney on co-conspirator 6's list. In an email, after the call, the Arizona attorney recounted his conversation with co-conspirator 5 as follows. "I just talked to the gentleman who did that memo, co-conspirator 5. His idea is basically that all of us, Georgia, Wisconsin, Arizona, Pennsylvania, etc., have our electors send in their votes, even though the votes aren't legal under federal law because they're not signed by the governor, so that the members of Congress can fight about whether they should be counted on January 6th. They could potentially argue that they're not bound by federal law because they're Congress and they make the laws, etc. Kind of wild, creative. I'm happy to discuss. My comment to him was that I guess there's no harm in it, legally at least. We could just be sending in fake electoral votes to Pence so that someone in Congress can make an objection when they start counting votes and start arguing that the fake votes should be counted." At Giuliani's direction, on December 10th, co-conspirator 5 sent points of contact in all targeted states except Wisconsin, which had already received his memos, and New Mexico, a streamlined version of the Wisconsin memo, which did not reveal the intended fraudulent use of the defendant's electors, and the fraudulent elector instructions along with fraudulent elector certificates that he had drafted. The next day, on December 11th, through Kenneth Cheeseborough, Giuliani suggested that the Arizona lawyer file a petition for certiorari in the Supreme Court as a pretext to the claim that the litigation was pending in the state to provide cover for the convening and voting of the defendant's fraudulent electors there. So the word of the day is certiorari, and it's a writ or order by a higher court to review a decision of a lower court. So for example, if a person loses in a federal court or the highest state court, they can create this petition so the Supreme Court can review the case. Okay, so Kenneth Cheeseborough explained that Giuliani had heard from a state official and state provisional elector that it could appear treasonous for the Arizona electors to vote on Monday if there is no pending court proceeding. To manage the plan in Pennsylvania, on December 12th, Giuliani and Cheeseborough and Co-Conspirator 6 participated in a conference call organized by the defendant's campaign with the defendant's electors in that state. When the defendant's electors expressed concern about signing certificates representing themselves as legitimate electors, Giuliani falsely assured them that their certificates would be used only if the defendant succeeded in litigation. Subsequently, Co-Conspirator 6 circulated proposed conditional language to the effect for potential inclusion in the fraudulent electors' certificates. A campaign official cautioned not to offer the conditional language to other states because, quote, the other states are signing what he prepared. If it gets out that we changed the language for Pennsylvania, it could snowball. In some cases, the defendant's electors refused to participate in the plan. On December 13th, Cheeseborough sent Giuliani an email memorandum that further confirmed that the conspirators' plan was not to use the fraudulent electors only in the circumstance that the defendant's litigation was successful in one of the targeted states. Instead, the plan was to falsely present the fraudulent slates as an alternative to the legitimate slates at the Congress certification proceeding. On December 13th, the defendant asked the senior campaign advisor for an update on what's going on with the elector plan and directed him to put out a statement on the electors. As a result, Giuliani directed the senior campaign advisor to join a conference call with him, Co-Conspirator 6, and others. When the senior campaign advisor related these developments and text messages to the deputy campaign manager, a senior advisor to the defendant, and a campaign staffer, the deputy campaign manager responded, "Here's the thing. The way this has morphed, it's crazy. It's a crazy play, so I don't know who wants to put their name on it." The senior advisor wrote, "Certifying illegal votes." In turn, the participants in the group text message refused to have a statement regarding electors attributed to their names because none of them could stand by it. On December 13th, at a campaign staffer's request, Cheeseborough drafted and sent a fraudulent elector certificates for the defendant's electors in New Mexico, which had not previously been among the targeted states, and where there was no pending litigation on the defendant's behalf. The next day, the defendant's campaign filed an election challenge suit in New Mexico at 11:54 a.m., 6 minutes before the noon deadline for the electors' votes. For the electors' votes as a pretext so that there was pending litigation there at the time the fraudulent electors voted. On December 14th, the legitimate electors of all 50 states in the District of Columbia met in their respective jurisdictions to formally cast their votes for the president, resulting in a total of 232 electoral votes for the defendant and 306 for Biden. The legitimate electoral votes that Biden won in the states that the defendant targeted and the defendant's margin of defeat were as follows. Arizona, 11 electoral votes, which is 10,457 votes. Georgia, 16 electoral votes, which is 11,779 votes. Michigan, 16 electoral votes, which is 154,888 votes. Nevada is 6 electoral votes, which is 33,596 votes. New Mexico, 5 electoral votes, which is 99,720 votes. Pennsylvania, which is 20 electoral votes, which equates to 80,555 votes. And Wisconsin, 10 electoral votes, which equals to 20,682 votes. On the same day, at the direction of the defendant and Giuliani, fraudulent electors convened sham proceedings in the 7 targeted states to cast fraudulent electoral ballots in favor of the defendant. In some states, in order to satisfy legal requirements set forth for legitimate electors under state law, state officials were enlisted to provide the fraudulent electors access to state capitol buildings so that they could gather and vote there. In many cases, however, as Chesbro had predicted in the fraudulent electors' instructions, the fraudulent electors were unable to satisfy the legal requirements. Nonetheless, as directed in the fraudulent elector instructions, shortly after the fraudulent electors met on December 14th, the targeted state's fraudulent elector certificates were mailed to the president of the Senate, the archivist of the United States, and others. The defendant and co-conspirators ultimately used the certificates of these fraudulent electors to deceitfully target the government function, and did so contrary to how fraudulent electors were told they would be used. Unlike those fraudulent electors, consistent with the ECA, the legitimate electors signed certificates were annexed to the state executive certificates of ascertainment before being sent to the president of the Senate and others. That evening at 6:26 p.m., the RNC chairwoman forwarded to the defendant through his executive assistant an email titled Electors Recap Final, which represented that in six contested states, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, the defendant electors had voted in parallel to Biden's electors. The defendant's executive assistant responded, "It's in front of him." The defendant's attempt to leverage the Justice Department to use deceit to get state officials to replace legitimate electors and electoral votes with the defendants. In late December 2020, the defendant attempted to use the Justice Department to make knowingly false claims of election fraud to officials in the targeted states through a formal letter under the acting Attorney General's signature, thus giving the defendant's lies the backing of the federal government and attempting to improperly influence the targeted states to replace legitimate Biden electors with the defendants. On December 22nd, the defendant met with the co-conspirator 4 at the White House. Co-conspirator 4 had not informed his leadership at the Justice Department
of the meeting, which was a violation of the Justice Department's written policy restricting contact with the White House to guard against improper political influence. On December 26, co-conspirator 4 spoke on the phone with the acting attorney general and lied about the circumstances of his meeting with the defendant at the White House, also claiming that the meeting had been unplanned. The acting attorney general directed co-conspirator 4 not to have unauthorized contact with the White House again, and co-conspirator 4 said he would not. The next morning, on December 27th, contrary to the acting attorney general's direction, co-conspirator 4 spoke with the defendant on the defendant's cell phone for nearly 3 minutes. That afternoon, the defendant called the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general and said, among other things, "People tell me co-conspirator 4 is great. I should put him in." The defendant also raised multiple false claims of election fraud, which the acting attorney general and the acting deputy attorney general refuted. When the acting attorney general told the defendant that the Justice Department could not and would not change the outcome of the election, the defendant responded, quote, "Just say that the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman." On December 28th, co-conspirator 4 sent a draft letter to the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general, which he proposed they all sign. The draft was addressed to state officials in Georgia, and co-conspirator 4 proposed sending versions of the letter to elected officials in the targeted states. The proposed letter contained numerous knowingly false claims about the election and Justice Department, including that A, the Justice Department had identified significant concerns that may have impacted the outcome of the election in multiple states. B, the Justice Department believed that in Georgia and other states, two valid slates of electors had gathered at the proper location on December 14th, and that both sets of ballots had been transmitted to Congress. That is, co-conspirator 4's letter sought to advance the defendant's fraudulent elector plan by using the authority of the Justice Department to falsely present the fraudulent electors as a valid alternative to the legitimate electors. And C, the Justice Department urged that the state legislature convene a special legislative session to create the opportunity to, among other things, to choose the fraudulent electors over the legitimate electors. The acting attorney general promptly responded to Jeffrey Clark, who was co-conspirator 4, by email and told him that his proposed letter was false, writing, "Despite dramatic claims to the contrary, we have not seen the type of fraud that calls into question the reported and certified results of the election." In a meeting shortly thereafter, the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general again directed Jeffrey Clark not to have unauthorized contact with the White House. On December 31st, the defendant summoned to the Oval Office the acting attorney general, acting deputy attorney general, and other advisors. In the meeting, the defendant again raised claims about the election fraud that Justice Department officials already had told him were not true, and that the senior Justice Department officials created were false, and suggested he might have to change the leadership in the Justice Department. On January 2nd, 2021, just 4 days before Congress's certification proceeding, Jeffrey Clark tried to coerce the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general to sign and send Clark's draft letter, which contained false statements, to state officials. He told them that the defendant was considering making Clark the new acting attorney general, but that Clark would decline the defendant's offer if the acting attorney general and acting deputy attorney general would agree to send the proposed letter to the targeted states. The Justice Department officials refused. Next day, on January 3rd, despite having uncovered no additional evidence of election fraud, Clark sent to the Justice Department colleague, an edited version of his draft letter to the states, which included a change from its previous claim that the Justice Department had concerns to a stronger false claim that states, as of today, there is evidence of significant irregularities that may have impacted the outcome of the election in multiple states. Also, on the morning of January 3rd, Clark Fuentes met with the defendant at the White House, again, without having informed senior Justice Department officials, and accepted the defendant's offer that he become acting attorney general. On the afternoon of January 3rd, Clark spoke with the deputy White House counsel. The previous month, the deputy White House counsel had informed the defendant that there was no option in which you do not leave the White House on January 20th. Now, that same deputy White House counsel tried to dissuade Clark from assuming the role of acting attorney general. The deputy White House counsel reiterated to Clark that there had not been an outcome determinative fraud in the election, and that if the defendant remained in the office nonetheless, there would be riots in every major city in the United States. Clark responded, "Well, Deputy White House Counsel, that's why there's an Insurrection Act." Also that afternoon, Clark met with the acting attorney general and told him that the defendant had decided to put Clark in charge of the Justice Department. The acting attorney general responded that he would not accept being fired by a subordinate and immediately scheduled a meeting with the defendant for that evening. On the evening of January 3rd, the defendant met for a brief briefing on the overseas national security issue with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and other senior national secretary advisors. The chairman briefed the defendant on the issue, which had previously arisen in December, as well as possible ways the defendant could handle it. When the chairman and other advisors recommended that the defendant take no action because Inauguration Day was only 17 days away and any course of action could trigger something unhelpful, the defendant calmly agreed, stating, "Yeah, you're right, it's too late for us. We're going to give that to the next guy." So we'll stop here. And next week we'll have the ending of this election indictment. Thank you for listening to the episode. I hope you have a great day. The song of the week is going to be Chase Shakur's Sink or Swim. I hope I didn't do that yet. And have a great day. Bye. Thank you for speaking our language.